Hello, everyone, and welcome to What's Wrong With The Podcast. Today, we're delighted to be talking to Manisha Amin. Manisha is the Chief Strategist and Visionary at Center for Inclusive Design. The Center for Inclusive Design builds inclusive platforms to create more value for industry, government, and most importantly, meaningful connection for and with the people who are marginalized. With a background in strategic marketing, communications, transforming cultures, and creativity, Manisha is a thought leader in the power of thinking from the edge. She has a unique talent for seeing beyond the horizon to emerging trends, defining them, and building powerful communities to bring them into being. Manisha has completed a Bachelor of Business Marketing, Master's of Professional Writing, and a PhD in Communications and Social Inquiry. Hi, Manisha.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you. We're so happy to have you here today. So for our audience, please tell us about yourself and how you got to start CFID.
Hey, so as you know, my name is Manisha Amin, and it was just a chance that I started up the center, actually. I have had a range of careers and jobs, and I you know, started off in marketing and social anthropology were the two key areas that I'd worked in before. But about 10 years ago, I was working for a university and didn't really know where I wanted to go next, and ended up working for an organization called Guide Dogs. And Guide Dogs help people who have who are blind or vision impaired with mobility, and that started me off in the not-for-profit sector. And about 3 years ago, I saw this ad for this very odd company called the actually Media Access Australia. I didn't really know what they were, but I thought I might as well try and apply and see what comes of this. And I rang them, and 2 weeks later, I had a job at this organisation. And really lovely organisation in Australia. We, back in the day, used to be the Australian Captioning Centre. And the Australian Captioning Centre lobbied to get captions to Australia for deaf people. And this is going back 30 years. And then there was no one to do the captions. So we ended up being the people who made the captions for deaf people. And the reason I mention that is because, you know, now when we think of captions, we don't think of captions as being something just for deaf people. If you look at the number of people on Facebook who use captions, when we go to, you know, the nail salon, when we lie in bed watching Game of Thrones with the sound off, captions are now ubiquitous for all of us. And I think that that idea was what started this notion of inclusive design. So we moved from that to looking at websites, because websites and technology made the world far more inclusive, and then not as inclusive. So, you know, it's the pendulum. So when I started at Media Access Australia, we really took those three words, media, access, and Australia, and thought, well, in the fourth industrial revolution, is media still a box and a screen that sits in a room anymore? Well, no, it's not. And what does access really mean? And why is access such a big problem? We have the tools, we have the resources. Why isn't everything just accessible? Why isn't it just a hygiene factor? And we came across this amazing concept called inclusive design, and a group in Canada, actually, the Inclusive Design Research Centre, and Yuta Trevoranis, and they came to Australia along with Kat Holmes from Microsoft. And that was in my first week. So all of a sudden, God. It was like, oh my God, there is this other world that we really need to be a part of. And that is how we, and then we went through a process. We spent 30 weeks talking to over 100 different organizations and edge user groups, and came up with the Center for Inclusive Design.
Amazing. And we're so happy that you did. So tell us, maybe going back to the root of the problem and why we need organizations like Center for Inclusive Design. What are you seeing out there, whether in corporations or government or any other organizations, where you think there is the need for organizations like you, who are not only advocating but educating everyone and delivering results that would make our environment more inclusive?
I think that when we started, I had a hypothesis which was wrong. My hypothesis was that everyone understood inclusion. It was just that we didn't know how to design it in. After 2.5 years, I've changed that hypothesis. My hypothesis now is people don't necessarily even understand human-centered design. And people don't have the time or feel they don't have the time to actually learn things.
Yeah.
Okay. We're all rushed. We're all busy. We want the answer and we need the checkbox and we need it now. And that's not being pejorative. It's actually just the way things are. And in Australia particularly, we've noticed in businesses, if you can feel it, if you can hold it, if you can play with it, it's easier to explain rather than having a more academic conversation.
True.
And so I think we saw three key needs. One was, what is inclusive design? Why does it matter? People saying, we know we need to do this stuff, but we don't have the time or the money. So really framing up a different conversation and making inclusion sexy, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the second part was a fear of the other. Okay. So when we did that strategic planning, the research in terms of how we became who we are, one of the biggest things that came up was this issue of fear and shame. So what would happen is people would say, I want to be a good person. Mm-hmm. There's a person over there with a so I'll use disability as an example. And disability is so important to the work we do because of the sensory qualities of disability, right? Like people who have a medical challenge will have a sensory superpower and a sensory deficit. And so both of those things are really important when you're thinking about really pushing your design and innovating from a sensory perspective. Forget lived experience, that's even greater. But I think that the challenge was that people would go, there's someone over there, they're different to me. So say that person might be an Auslan speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So Auslan is our, like American Sign Language, it's our sign language.
Yeah.
We might go, well, I don't know how to speak to them. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to do the wrong thing. So what I'll do is I'll just avoid them. But we don't like avoiding people who we know that intuitively we shouldn't avoid. So what happens? We feel a bit ashamed about doing that. You know, so I feel ashamed now that I've avoided that person. So it goes down one more level. And when we feel ashamed, we get angry. We run away a bit more. We blame that person. So now it's not the medical disability that they had that's creating their exclusion. It's our own judgment of ourselves that is creating that. So, and the reason I say this is one of the core principles of inclusive design is nothing for us without us. And, you know, that came from the disability movement, but this idea of what is co-design without power, without power on the side of the designer, that is really fundamental. And it allows us to break what just happened with fear and shame. It allows us to start constructive dialogue again. Allows us to talk to people in a way that's a bit mediated, which feels safer.
Why do you think that initial gut reaction is, I don't want to do the wrong thing, or like kind of fear, oh, that person is different, so I don't know if I should be trying to communicate to them or stay away. Like, where does that initial gut reaction come from, where we are designed to be social beings? I mean, technically it shouldn't matter that we're different. We see another social being, we should interact, right? Like, where does that built-in thing come from that leads to so many undesirable consequences?
Well, this will be my opinion rather than anything else. But so my opinion is that we're taught to like people who are like us.
I agree.
You know, we're taught. So if you think about Todd Rose's work, and if you've heard of the end of average, this idea, so he worked at the Harvard Mind and Brain Institute. He talks a lot about some of those stories that we used to hear in a design space around, you know, the design of cockpits, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've heard those before.
Yeah.
So, but I think we design for people like us. And if we think even of the schooling system, it's designed around this mythical notion of average.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the average student is, or the best student is someone who's good at everything.
Right.
Whereas actually all of us are good at some things. All of us are good at not good at other things. We are taught to look for people who somehow are like us. We look for people who are fit. We privilege pictures and images of people who are good looking. Good looking people have a better time of things, right? So we have a bias to what standard is, and then we try to make things fit that standard, and we're not used to having other people around, and therefore we don't understand how to deal with the other.
Right.
We hide people with disability away.
Exactly. So true. So, and also, like, what if we're designing for people like us, or we hang out with people like us? It's sort of,
yeah, completely.
It becomes even a bigger problem when there is a built-in inequality or equity issue in the system of different, I guess, abilities, really. Demographics. So then if we're like, this area is like working on designing things for each other, and this area is more concerned about food access and things like that, then it's...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a project this is my passion project at the moment, is actually looking at the robots that people have in schools. Because, so, you know, those inclusion robots?
Yeah.
Have you noticed all the robots look the same?
True.
Right? So where's the representation of our community? Like, why is everything exactly the same? I get it's standardization, right? But it's subconsciously...
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
Exactly.
Our studio did a project with an organization that does fascinating work too, where we actually redesigned body forms in retail stores. Because,
right.
Like, if you want to... First of all, it's poor business. If you want to sell to everyone, you should be representative of everyone. Right? Like, just because a person has a disability doesn't mean their money is disabled. Like, that judgment is already false. But then also, like, no one wants to, and then some brands do it totally wrong. Like, they're like, okay, here is our inclusive section. Terrible.
Yes.
So, like, we basically recreated body forms where, like, we basically showed different postures or positions that would be inclusive of people with disabilities too. So I totally get it. I mean, we totally approach an inanimate object, but it's about representation.
So if you think about, you know, industrialization, this notion of conformity has probably helped, because it kind of makes sense. You make all of your, you know, store dummies the same shape. It means that you know exactly what product you can fit on those.
Yep.
And go through a mass produced system really simply.
Yep.
But the challenge of that, is really that we're starting to feed that bias that we have.
Exactly.
And I think where inclusive design comes in is that it comes from that whole idea of universal design and human-centered design, those approaches. But the argument is really that with technology, those barriers that we had that meant everything had to be exactly the same, changes. So the way we think about affordances changes, because technology allows us to have a broader approach, right? So, like, we look at a smartphone, we all use smartphones, but not, I would guess, well, most of us use smartphones if we can afford them. But if you think about how we use them, no two people use them exactly the same way.
Sure.
And we're able to do that because there's technology that's built in there that makes those phones more inclusive. So if it wasn't for people with carpal tunnel and the technology that was designed then around gesture control, I don't know whether we would have had gesture control in the phones the way we do. If it wasn't for voiceover and sound systems that were made for people who couldn't hear, I don't know if we would have ended up with Siri.
Sure, I 100% agree. We wouldn't even have touch screens at all.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or email, or flexible straws, or you know, electric toothbrushes or curb cuts. So the number of examples goes on and on. But where there's a hard edge, creativity happens, right?
Yeah. And I think, like, we have all these examples, right? Like, and we're in the year of 2020, which feels like, you know, feels like chaos the entire year, really. But we should be at a point where we have sufficient case studies that shows inclusive design is better design. Mm. Why do you think it's still a hard conversation with so many corporations or organizations?
Because we don't have diversity in the workplace.
Right. Going back to representation. Yeah.
It goes back to representation. So we have been playing with this a lot. So our model is that we're a very tiny team. There's only 10 of us.
Mm-hmm.
But when we do projects, we bring in people who represent the communities we're working with.
Yeah.
And we've done this in different ways. So sometimes we do this by having a brains trust that become my advisory group. So in fact, the board of directors are people from the community, if you like.
Yeah.
Sometimes our project manager will be somebody from a community. And we were doing some work recently around phones, and I think it was actually around smart apps for people who couldn't hear. And what we were trying to do is work out what the functional requirements of the smart apps were. And this client wouldn't pay and didn't have the time for work with the community. Okay, so they kind of said, look, we don't have the ability to go out to everybody at this point. We need this in 3 days' time.
Right.
And so we have a methodology that we use and a model for designing, doing functional mapping. The project manager we had was designed to also come into our team. He had two implants, one cochlear, one other implant. He worked in education. He'd been in the community for a very long time. And in fact, he was coordinating that piece of work. And we did a trial the day before he came in, and then when he came in. And the result, just having an older male in the room, was completely different. And then when we did our testing later, we found that the functional specs that were our hypothesis were actually bang on. But it was because we had a diverse group. If we'd done that without that person, we wouldn't have had half the insights that we did.
This is such an important point, because, you know, I feel like so many teams would also like sort of justify, oh, but we do research of those people, let's say, and the quote unquote those.
Yeah.
Or like we can empathize, or we can mimic like their movements or whatever. Like people think they can empathize and they can research sufficiently enough that their design might be inclusive. But that learned experience of like them really like living that on a day-to-day basis has so much more insight into the process that I don't understand how it's missed. Like if you're designing a hair salon for women, people would know like, okay, we should get women's point of view, right? Like, or I feel like if it's an all men designed woman hair salon, people could be called out on it. But I don't, like, it's really hard to see like this is not the case for people with disabilities.
Yeah. And I think there's two sides to that coin. One is the different, there's one side which is around co-design, I think, and this idea that if we bring people in, we can design for them even. So can we actually design for somebody else just by hearing what they have? So where does, because there, of course, the power still sits with the designer. So how do we actually do participatory design? As an old market researcher, I was always taught to sort of stand back, not have my own judgment. But doing participatory design, what I love is this idea of walking together, walking side by side, and actually having an equal relationship. So there's that side first of all. So when people say, you know, we'll just do some quantitative research, I'm like, well, you can do quant, but are you actually going to get a participatory approach? It's very binary, right?
Exactly.
And then the second part is the diversity of teams. So people will often say, but, you know, they're not designers, so I still need to have control. But I think, would you get a school teacher to design your bank? No.
Exactly.
But would you have somebody who is a female of that age who has the right experience to design your bank? Yeah. So we need diversity in our design teams, so that we know what we're talking about. And often what we've been saying is, forget disability. Do you think it's okay for an all-male group who are 25 to design something for, do you think it's all right for an all-male group to design tampons? You know? Would you say that? No, you wouldn't. So I think, and when we go to those examples, people just get it easily. And I'm not being, you know, I hope I'm not being inappropriate.
No, but it's absolutely correct. Like, we need to break down the conversation to the point that it's really conceivable, you know?
Yeah, because, and it's funny, you know, like you would never expect that. You would never, and in the past, has that happened? 100% it has happened, right? 100%. But it's this idea that we need to start thinking about things that way. And when we do that, then that idea, if we can use inclusion from our own experience, then it's easier for us to understand how inclusion works with other people.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I definitely agree. I think like even like personally, you know, I consider myself as a person who can empathize with others or are considerate about others, you know, and if I'm doing a work, I want to make sure it appeals to all. But even in that scenario, I never got it. I know I witnessed myself that I never got it until I was exposed and tried to work with the people that we're designing for, right? Like, it's just, you can't.
It's really hard. But we're not taught this way, right? In schools, we're not taught that the student has the same rights and power as the teacher.
True.
You know, education 2.0 is moving in that direction.
Yeah.
But we're still taught that you have to respect the person that has all the knowledge that has come from books more than lived experience.
Yeah.
You know, and I really worry at this point with COVID, et cetera, where we have so many people who've lost their jobs. When you have a choice between a person, you know, who might be a wheelchair user coming into an organization who might need some extra supports, or somebody who suffers from crippling anxiety or ADHD, where they can do the work, but it might, that they can't necessarily work in the system that we've created that privileges people who are verbose, who are not wheelchair users, who, you know, and we kind of go, well, we'll hire that person now when we have two people because they somehow are able to fit our system better.
Yeah. And make things more efficient, fast, easier for them to work with.
Exactly. Because it buys into our biases. And it's not for me about going the person, you know, who is an edge user can work as well or as efficiently in our system. But what is wrong with our system? What do we need to change with the system so that it's easy to include other people?
Yeah.
Because if it's easy to include other people, we won't feel that fear and shame.
Right, right. Like layered though, right? Like the systemic issues, like it starts off, as you mentioned, education. And during education, we are introduced to also some biases or judgments, right? And then you want to go into workforce. There are certain perceptions around that. So even like you yourself might try to adapt to just to like get it, right? And then obviously we talked about privilege before, like people who started where like things were just easier, whether that's economically, whereas that's physically, they hold a certain majority in workforce. So they sort of like feed down, similar to the education system, that bias or expectation of all the workforce.
Yeah.
And then if we go up, even government does not necessarily set a great example of being inclusive or accessible. Like the voting system is designed to fail. Right? Like it's not accessible. Public education system is not accessible. So many of cities are not accessible physically. Like New York City, definitely not accessible, right? So there's so many systemic issues that are sort of feeding to this problem where it seems to be, and I would love to get your opinion on this too, for organizations like yourself, it really goes back to not only just doing the design work of like human-centered design, but also to educating and really raising awareness. Like even if we're in 2020, we're still at the process where we have to have a constant conversation about this. So even though, you know, I mean, some people might change during this time, but even if they don't, the generations coming up are actually, they don't know anything but inclusive design. You know, like hoping we get to a point of that. But what do you think?
Wouldn't that be amazing? So I think there's two sides to that. One is, I guess the methodology we use has underlying it two key, I think, three key principles. One is really around bias and recognizing our own biases and making decisions, okay? Because we can't change everything in one go and nothing in my view, I think it would be very hard to get something that is inclusive for every single person all the time, because we're so diverse, right? Working with people. And then the last part, which I think sometimes when we're looking particularly at the world of accessibility, this part is forgotten, and that is that we work in a complex, dynamic, adaptive system. So it's constantly changing. We're not going to get this right.
Right.
We're not going to get it right because the world is consistently changing. So what's right today might not be right tomorrow. So there's no right about this. There's no end point. It's just like a different way of working. And because of that, it's actually about how we do it, not what comes out at the end that's the most important. Because as we include more and more people in our decision-making and different people in our decision-making, stuff we make is going to just be better, more nimble, more robust. And then that in itself will create more inclusion. So it becomes a virtuous cycle.
Yeah.
We're not taken out by a vicious cycle. We're not taken out by being tone deaf.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is covered. We're not, you know, the accessibility piece becomes grammar. So it's not a nice to have. It's a must have. So, you know, and we come up with different solutions then as well. So, and it's no judgment. So we meet people where they are. And we work from there, because I think if we work from the frame that everyone's doing the best they can with the right intentions, it's still hard. I hate it when people tell me I'm wrong. So I try to be wrong a lot. I try to say the wrong thing a lot, and I try to practice my own biases in a way, because I figure if I'm getting it wrong and people are correcting me, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, I didn't know that, then that gives other people the ability to do that as well.
Right.
And the more we're wrong, the better we'll be.
So, so true. Wow. I think that was really, really well put. And it's such a, like, I guess, you know, it's so true that you said, we'll never get it right, right? Like, it's almost like it's a iteration process. Like, everything we put out there sort of has to be seen as a prototype that worked today or temporarily or for a certain user set.
Yes.
And then how do we sort of expand that or iterate that? So I think technology and, you know, digital presence that we have enabled for more rapid iteration. So we see accessibility measures more and 100%. More incorporated in technology. And we don't necessarily see that in more, like ancient industries or like dated industries such as construction and architecture, unfortunately. Mm. Like any accessibility, like compliance or regulations that are brought, I mean, I'm thankful that governments come up with those, but we all know they're not sufficient, right? Like we know it doesn't end with putting a ramp, or it doesn't end with putting Braille into signage. So I think, you know, we're sort of setting up people, and you talked about like meeting them where they are. It's so true, because like we're so used to having everyone adapt to this existing system that is built by we don't even know who, like white men probably who are not disabled, right? And everyone's expected to adapt to that. Even a new mom who is sort of pumping in office environment has to like do it in a bathroom because there's no area for her to do that. Or, you know, I have a close friend who has a paralysis in her both arms. The company she works in, she can't open the doors.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so... And we're expected everyone to meet us there. We're not necessarily, and in the design process, it's such a false thinking, because let's say all employers, and I think this COVID sort of changed this a little bit, but pre-COVID, they were kind of like, okay, everyone's working from 9 to 7, right? And let's say a person has a disability that really doesn't allow for them to do that, especially like on the screen all the time. Let's say you have visual impairment or whatever that is. And then, okay, they didn't meet our standards, so that's why they were let go, or that's why we can't work with people that have such disabilities. But then again, like that person can make one comment that is so essential to the design process and really like defines the design that it will be irrelevant how many hours they work. It will be irrelevant how they come to work, if they come to work physically, you know? However, like meeting them where they are, and that is actually the really core way of how we can have an inclusive design process.
And I think it's also going one that extra step to the social model of disability. You know, in the past, disability was about a medical model. So we were trying to help people who had a medical disability. And today our model is that, you know, that disability is really a mismatch between an individual and the environment.
Exactly.
And so if you go back to that example of a ramp, certainly we wouldn't have ramps if it wasn't for, you know, Ed Roberts and the rolling quads and you know, those wheelchair users who actually in the 1960s who really fought for curb cuts. You know, we wouldn't have ramps. But those ramps, if you look at train stations or curb cuts, not only do we all use them, we all need them. We need them if we've got a pram. We need them if we've got shopping trolleys with us. We need them if we've broken our leg, you know, situational disability, temporary disability. So I think it's not so much for me at the moment, you know, absolutely it's about helping others, but it's actually about shining a light on the things that we're all having problems experiencing and reframing the world a little bit for all of us. And in fact, my I guess my advice is when we think about involving people who are from the edge. So for us, inclusive design is anyone who's missing out on a good or service or experience. So it could be somebody who might, you know, if you're a car driver or driverless car, it would be someone who couldn't see or someone who couldn't use the pedals could potentially be the people we'd be talking to. So that you get that really lovely sort of diversity. Or young people, children. Children are not car drivers either. So it's whoever's missing out. And then also looking at the frame of disadvantage. I don't think you need the middle. So I don't think that we need to go, we need to do this group and that group.
Yeah.
In fact, that group has, because of intersectionality, they have a lot of those experiences. You know, we in Australia, we for the first time, we're the only nation in the English-speaking world that doesn't have audio description on our broadcast televisions. And that is coming in the next month to our two government stations. And one of the questions people asked us was, the stations were saying, well, what sort of programs do people watch? What would they want to have on audio described? And I was like, well, what does everybody else watch? It's actually the same. So you don't need to have one part of the research looking at what everybody, in fact, if we just use this group, we'd get what everybody watches.
Yeah.
So you'd still be saving money, but you'd get two lots of experiences. You'd get what everybody watches, plus you'd get the impact of having to turn on a remote control if you can't see the remote control and you're trying to get on audio description or captioning or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Which would then also work for people who are elderly who are struggling with their remote controls. So, or young children who are struggling with remote controls when they've got less mobile or dexterity. And for all of us, it means we can turn our remote control on in the dark, you know.
Yeah.
So by actually just working on the edge all the time, we get the middle ground.
Yeah, that's a beautiful saying. I love that. So you touched upon it a little bit, but if you had one-liner advice to anyone who wanted to go into inclusive design, anyone who wanted to work in a organization or sector that sort of addresses social injustice, what would you say?
Right. For people in companies, I have some questions I'd be asking. So the first question is really around my own bias. So who am I designing for and who haven't I designed for? Sit down with a pen and paper and go, who have I not designed for? And think about it from your sensory perspective. What if someone can't see? What if someone can't hear? What if someone can't do? The second question is, who have I included or not included when I'm designing? And make sure my MVP comes from the edge. You can't go, we'll just design for the middle people like me first and then we'll add on the extra. You've got to do it the other way around. And the third one is actually a framework we use it's actually the universal design principles, but we use a framework from the playground movement here, which is, can I get there? Can I play there? And can I stay there? Which takes into account the system, right? So can I get to whatever it is? Can I use it? And can I stay there is, do I feel safe and comfortable here? What's my experience? So those three sets of questions are a really simple way of working out what's not working.
Yeah, and really approach any subject.
Completely.
I love that.
Completely. So that's what I'd say to people in companies. For people wanting to get involved in inclusive design, it's not as scary or as hard as it seems. But we also, on our site for Global Accessibility Awareness Day, we actually asked a whole lot of people to put to give us some resources that we've put on our website. And these are things that were light bulb moments for them, or resources that helped to explain inclusive design. So if any of your listeners would like to add something that they have seen, they're more than welcome to. And case studies, but we're actually just trying to build a repository of information. So some people, there's books on there, there's podcasts, there's articles, all sorts of different ways of thinking about things, case studies.
Wonderful. Well, this was amazing. Thank you so much, Manisha, for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the What's Wrong with Synopsis. Inclusive design, universal design, or human-centered design. What does it mean when we talk about or create with all these design methods? These methods of design were developed to ensure that everyone enjoys the products and services that designers create. A good designer is one who has the capacity for empathy and wants to create designs for all people. But a great designer will include the people he or she is designing with within the process of design. What we really need are designers who have experienced barriers. We need to stop accepting into our design teams only a uniform set of individuals with specific competencies. Because each feature created by designers in a product or service determines who can interact with it or who is left out. We need design teams with individuals who can each contribute a different perspective. Inclusive design helps designers create products and services that serve as many people as possible. While accessibility is a core objective, inclusion means much more because it enables people with diverse characteristics to use a product or service in a variety of different environments. So, inclusive design doesn't mean designing one thing for all people. Actually, what you're designing is a diversity of ways to participate in an experience so that everyone can have a sense of belonging. Inclusive design is also a win-win for both businesses and their customers, since around the world, over 1 billion people have an impairment of some sort. This market is sadly largely untapped. Inclusive design is about recognizing the mismatched interactions between people and their world. It is about seeking out the expertise of people who navigate exclusionary designs every day of their lives. It's about designing not only for, but with.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Tune in next week for a brand new episode. For more details on our guests, follow us on Instagram and Twitter. For more information on our events and podcasts, visit us at whatswrongwith.xyz.